This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by Lucy Hardy from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation to talk about how she's transitioned her career into being a digital team lead. This week's show is sponsored by Headscape and the Digital Project Manager School. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG. Joining me on this week's show, Marcus Linnington, obviously. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. You've gone very proper on me.
Well, I have those moments.
Very 1950s.
Well, I'm putting on my Radio 4 voice that you have to. And more importantly, Lucy Hardy from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, it's Ellen MacArthur Foundation.
Oh yeah, it is, isn't it? McCarthy, I said. Yeah, that's the wrong MacArthur.
Well, getting the name wrong, that's something. It had to happen one day, didn't it, Paul?
Well, it happens blooming every time. It's just, it's normally the name that I get wrong is normally the name of the guest rather than the name of the organization. So I was concentrating on the name of the guest rather than the organization. I should know this, as I have been working with you for now, what, 3 or 4 months, is it?
Yes, yes. It's a good good test of how much you've been listening.
So, not at all. Yes, get the name of the company wrong. How do you feel now, Paul?
Yeah. Although that's not the best one. Sorry, tangent straight away. So we had a son of a friend staying with us over the last couple of days because he's at university and his parents live out in India. So obviously he can't go home to India every time. So he came to stay with us, and he'd been staying with his auntie and uncle in Bournemouth. And I had it in my head that he was staying with my Indian friend's sister, right? So I went and picked them up. I walked into the room, right? And there is a Caucasian white lady standing there and an Indian guy who looks just like my friend, right? And I turn to her and say, "So, you're about being Simon's sister?" And she's just nothing like him whatsoever in any stretch of the imagination. But I had it stuck in my head, so I made a complete arse of myself. Talking of making complete arses.
Again.
So there you go. So, yes, Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Tell us about it, Lucy. What do they do?
What do we do? So we have a mission to accelerate the transition to a circular economy, which I'll try and explain what that means. But essentially, we're a charity with this big global mission. And the circular economy, well, actually, the best way to probably describe what a circular economy is to describe what it's not. Right. So we currently live in a linear economy. So we extract finite resources out of the ground, we make products with them, and ultimately we throw them away. And this is at great economic cost, so a huge amount of lost value and obviously environmental degradation. The circular economy is an entirely different system where we design it from the beginning to be regenerative by design. And that basically means it runs on three sort of broad principles. We design out waste and pollution from the start, we regenerate natural systems, and we keep products in use as long as possible. That's right. Kind of the quick version.
I have an example.
Yes. So,
sorry, Marcus. The only reason that I'm having Lucy as a guest on the show is so she can explain this, so I now understand it. Because I couldn't ask her it as a potential supplier. I'm just expected to know. But if I get her on the podcast, then yeah, sorry. Example.
That's true.
Give an example.
It's the first time you've asked, so that's good.
I'd read it on the website. In my defence.
So an example from the technical cycle is you can take the idea of, well, you can take a washing machine as an example. In a linear economy, obviously, they maybe a cheap to medium value washing machine maybe lasts a couple of years before you end up throwing it away and it ends up in landfill predominantly. In a circular system, it would be designed from the beginning to be completely disassemblable and can be reused. So every component would be made to be reused again. And that means that there's a huge amount of value contained within that washing machine. So actually the benefit is for the manufacturer or the brand who has that washing machine to actually retain ownership of it, because they want those parts back to make the next washing machine. So they might not sell you the washing machine. They might lease the washing machine to the customer. And that solves the problem, obviously, ultimately, of it being thrown away. The customer, on the other hand, should get a much better deal. So it might not be a straight rental agreement. It might be paying for your clean clothes rather than for the washing machine. So you're paying for the value that you're getting rather than the way that you're getting it. So you might pay per wash. That could include the electricity to run the machine. It could include like the detergent, the full package. And it completely kind of reinvents the relationship with the customer at the same time.
That's brilliant. And it's brilliant for a couple of reasons. Two things that really excite me about that. One is that the way you describe it isn't about, you know, you don't take that, oh, we need to save the planet approach. You talk about the economics of it and how it's better for companies and it's better for consumers, right? And that's like the equivalent that immediately springs to mind is where I come across user experience designers who talk about the benefit to the user, and nobody really cares about the benefit of the user, right? That's the holier than thou bit. Oh, we shouldn't use dark patterns because they're unethical, right? Well, no, that's not good enough. You need to talk about the benefit to the organization. So that was one thing that really excited me about it. The other thing that excited me about it is that you were talking there about this idea of paying per wash, right? And I've got a printer now, which is the HP Tango printer. And yes, I did pay a fee to buy it outright, but then essentially I subscribe to ink, right? But I'm not subscribing to the ink. I'm not getting ink delivered once a month or whatever. I'm subscribing per print I make. And they always make sure ink arrives when I'm getting low on it, and they recycle the cartridges that I produce as well. And it's just, that's exactly the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we work with also Philips, and they have been installing kind of what they call their pay per lux scheme, which is where they will provide lighting to offices around the world and just charge them. They pay the electricity bill. So they're actually incentivized to use the best products. They want them to last as long as possible, yeah, and to make the best energy savings, because actually they're footing the bill, and it completely changes the dynamic, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And yes, I know, Marcus, what you're about to say. You're about to comment on Andrew in the chat room that is
asked
why I'm
dressed
like... It was a
guest a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he's a guest. That's what he is. Who says that I'm dressed like a snooker player today? Which I think is very rude of him. No, so that's really... I'm really into this. I'm really into this whole idea of reimagining business models, turning them on their heads and approaching them completely differently. And I, like, for example, I'm really into smart devices and the Internet of Things and all of that kind of stuff. And the opportunities that opens up to just reimagine how products work in a completely different way, that when those products are connected... You know, the trouble is, if people think of the web, oh, it's a great marketing channel, but it can be so much more than just a marketing channel. It can completely redesign and reimagine how we go about products. So, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, actually, we talk about, as an organization, the role of digital in the transition to a circular economy as being a massive enabler. I don't think this could have happened. You know, a lot of the ideas behind it have been around for a long time, but now is the moment of time to do it, because actually it couldn't have happened before digital. Things like being able to track products as they move across global supply chains. I mean, digital is the enabler for that. That's really how businesses can start engaging with it.
Yeah.
I've got one question.
Go on.
Which is general, or maybe not generally speaking, but to make this happen, is there a certain amount of kind of goodwill required from business? You know, do we need to be doing the right thing? Because I'm basically, is it going to cost more? I suppose is what I'm trying to say. In the first instance,
it's a motivator.
Yeah, that's my question. Yeah.
It's definitely a motivator, but it's not the core argument. A bit like Paul's just said, from the outset, we looked at this as an economic opportunity. And I think that's had a huge, been a huge helping factor in the momentum behind the idea, because it's not a cost. It is also an opportunity, and it's a win-win. There are downsides. It won't always be a win-win, but generally speaking, it's in businesses' interests. Like, we speak their language around it, and I think that has helped us to bring everyone along with us.
Cool. I had a friend that spent years developing kind of safety exit lights using LEDs back when LEDs weren't really a thing.
Yeah.
And they last something 10, 15 times longer than the ones that are normally installed, but they did cost kind of three times more. So, you know, last 10 times longer, cost three times more, but they were never spec'd because they cost three times more. That's kind of where that thought came from. So I think, you know, is there an education piece in this as well? I think there must be to a certain extent. But
yeah, and the key, you know, the key is, like in my example, is that you don't put that cost onto the customer. The businesses bear that cost. So you incentivize them to invest in the best quality manufacturing and the best quality materials, because they actually are the ones that are fronting the bill.
It's about planning for the long term, isn't it? It's about taking a long-term business perspective rather than the short term. Again, if we go back to the idea of dark patterns, you know, and introducing these manipulative user experience elements. But dark patterns work. You know, they work. They work in the short term. They will cause a jump in your conversion rate over the short term. But you've got to think about the long-term cost to the business. The same is true with your LED lights. Yeah, they cost more in the short term, but over the long term, they're better.
And yeah, I think the problem was with just the way, you know, building is done around the world, especially large builds. It's just based on box ticking. There wasn't enough thought went into the process, which is a shame, real shame.
So I have been working, as I said, with Lucy for the last 3 months or so, because Lucy runs the digital team. I was about to say small digital team, but it's actually quite big considering the size of the charity and the number of employees. And you kind of head up that team. Is that the way that it should be described, Lucy?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
I have to be a bit careful because you have this triumvirate, don't you? It's of the three of you that kind of conspire together to bring everybody else in the organization online. It's very mafia-like, Marcus, if I'm honest.
Oh, yeah. Scary.
Yes, yeah. So I work very closely with our digital program lead and our technical lead. And the three of us take a lot of decisions together, which I think has just been really helpful in having a completely sort of aligned perspective and having really clear champions for what we're trying to do has been super helpful.
So I've got one question before we jump onto the first sponsor that I do want to quickly talk about, which is, how long have you been involved in digital?
About 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
She is running a digital team for about 4 years and didn't really have digital experience before that. And when and bearing in mind, you've been off on maternity leave fairly recently as well, that cut across that, and I have to say it is the best run. They couldn't believe, they didn't accept me when I said this to begin with. I think they were a bit in shock, but it's the best run digital team I have ever been involved in mentoring. They've completely nailing it as an in-house team, and they're doing such good things, which is really annoying because I have to up my game in order to be able to. Oh, Andrew, I just really offended Andrew in the chat room. Very different circumstances, Andrew. You've got a lot of constraints on you. I mean, it is worth saying, that you've also got a very supportive organisation that are very up for change and doing things differently, which kind of helps, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
Of course. It's a huge factor. And I think, you know, we have a lot of appetite for making bold decisions. It's sort of in our DNA. It's in our kind of fabric in taking on such a huge global mission. I think it kind of permeates into the culture. So that's really helpful.
Yeah. So, Andrew, it's fine. You're special in your own certain way.
Yeah, Andrew, it's just, there'll be just more work. He's just sucking up.
Oh, arse. Yeah, whoever's my current client is my favourite client. I'm very fickle like that. So, the reason I wanted to get Lucy on the show is because I haven't had time to really delve in with her. That transition of going from a completely non-digital background to transitioning into digital and then getting to such an incredible place in quite an aggressive time scale. So I want to talk about that a little bit. But before we talk about that, let's talk about the digital project manager, talking about transitioning and learning new skills. And I want to say a huge thanks for these guys who've been supporting the whole season. It's not a big organization, the Digital Project Management School. So this was a big investment for them to support us across the whole season. So please take the time to check them out. If for no other reason than to say thank you for supporting the show, you can check them out at thedigitalprojectmanager.com/BOAG World. Just a quick reminder about what they do. So they've got an interactive learning experience, not just a course, a learning experience, mind you. It's got video lessons, weekly panel discussions, assignments. Now, is that really a selling point? We give you homework. Group discussions, coaching sessions. So really, it's for anyone trying to land or have just landed their first project management role within the digital space. People looking to boost their skills and confidence in managing complex digital projects. Even to be honest, seasoned project managers who want to refine their approach and keep up with latest best practice. So it's you know, some proper decent training, but presented in a kind of very informal, enjoyable way. They've helped organizations such as Sony Music, Microsoft, Siemens, Dow Jones, loads of different organizations. So check them out at thedigitalprojectmanager.com/BOAG World. Right.
Before we get going, Paul, and I don't normally do this, but and because it's an audio podcast, but I've got to show you a picture.
Oh,
so this is just for you. No, this is cool. Check this out. This is what a chimney sweep got out of our chimney this morning. Let's see if I can get it on there. Can you see it? You can't see
it. Oh, that's disgusting.
Look at that.
When was the last time you did your chimney?
Well, it's a gas fire, so it basically had to be completely blocked before we knew it.
Blimey. So,
but it's like... anyway, sorry. Carry on, as you were.
What was that to do with anything, Marcus?
It was to do with while you were doing the hugely exciting sponsor slot, I was looking at my phone.
Ben, I apologise. Ben is the guy that runs the Digital Project Manager School. Marcus is no way affiliated with this show. He just turns up every week. Yeah, as they're saying in the chat room, you need to focus.
I don't know, I'm in a naughty mood today, and I don't know why. Why? Oh, why is it?
So, Lucy, tell us your background. Before you got into the digital world, what was it that you were doing?
Yeah.
Were you at the same charity for a start?
I was, yeah. So I actually joined the foundation as one of their very first communications team employees.
Ooh.
Mm. And before that, I'd been living in London and doing freelance comms and marketing stuff, and also a stint in film and TV, working on film sets. But it wasn't really for me. It's a bit of a mixed bag. But yeah, I sort of came at it through the communications team way originally, and about 2 years into doing that with the foundation, we had an agency who we were really struggling with. And it's funny to think back on it now, but true to sort of foundation style, I suppose, we thought, oh, well, maybe we could do this better ourselves, which is hugely naive. But actually it's worked out all right, I think.
Yeah.
And there were a few of us who sort of set out on this this quest to start a digital team, and none of us had actually been paid to do digital before ever. So we had a developer who was self-taught and had spent the last 18 months teaching himself. Hugely intelligent guy, sort of really big brain in theoretical physics, but had never built a website for anybody. there was me, who was a project manager, and one of our graphic designers decided that she'd like to give it a go at doing web design now. And that was really our first team, and that's how we started.
And that is so far. I mean, that just, it rings every alarm bell in my head possible. It makes my skin crawl. It's like the worst idea ever. Yeah, setting up your own internal digital team, absolutely fine. But you're getting people that know what they're doing. I mean, this is just insanity. How the hell did this manage to work?
Yeah, it reminds me of the start of Headscape.
Yeah, hang on a minute.
I'm joking.
You and Chris might not have known how to build websites, but I did. I was the only, there were three of us, and one of us knew how to do any work. Ridiculous setup. Anyway, as Andrew's just said in the chat room, you know, that's how all of us started, really. At some point, we've all had to learn it. But there's very different, I guess, just being dropped in the deep end, in an organization. And of course, you know, in my situation, was my experience as well. I was working as a multimedia designer. I didn't know what the internet was. I got given the internet to do. But back then, that wasn't that complicated. Do you know what I mean? All you had to do is learn HTML. You didn't even have to learn CSS or JavaScript, let alone React and Node and all of these other things that are flying around today. So what an amazing learning curve you guys have had.
Yeah, it was very steep. And actually, the first project that we were doing was, not just any old website, we were creating the website for an interactive learning festival.
Which is a huge thing.
An interactive part.
it's got more interactive. Time's gone on. But that was our first project. So it wasn't sort of any kind of static website, not that they are anymore anyway. But it was a challenging first project. We learned a lot of lessons on it.
So how did you go? Was there any method to your madness? You know, did you have we're going to set aside a day a week for learning, or I don't know. How did you approach it?
We didn't set aside like specific time for learning, but I think we were humble enough to realize we didn't know what we were doing. So sort of actually going out there and finding out what good looks like was the first priority. And that's really how we started. So we went and actually met some digital teams and saw the different ways that different teams were structured in different companies. We connected with some people in our network for advice. We started looking online at who was doing this really well. I know it's a really common example, but the government digital service, that service manual provided a lot of inspiration to us in the early days. We were constantly looking for what we could be emulating, and it provided a standard to work towards right from the beginning, which was so important. And I think also we are a learning organisation. So we make a lot of time, or there's a lot of time protected internally for learning the things that you need to learn. So we didn't at the time need to like make specific blocks of times. So it was kind of accepted that sort of as an individual or as a team, you would do that as part of your role and take the time that you need. And there's not any kind of justification of that. It's just very much supported.
And the other thing that you seem very well supported over is resources. So you started off as the three of you, but you grew pretty quickly, I would have thought, from there. So how did you decide how to grow? So many web teams that I encounter kind of just grow organically, or we've got too much development work, we'll hire a developer. But you seem to have been a little bit more strategic about it than that.
I think we've had maybe our biggest growth spurt more recently. So we're now a team of about 13, and we've got four more hires coming on in the next 6 months or so. So it's getting bigger all the time. And I think now, obviously, we've been forced to really look at it and have a bit more of a strategy around how we resource. Initially, it was just sort of the approach. We hired a lot of designers and developers to get the work done, and didn't have enough of the support roles. So we still don't have enough of the kind of project managers, product managers, UX folks, content folks. You know, there's a lot of those kind of supporting roles that we just weren't put in place early on. So we very quickly got overwhelmed, and we very quickly got into a mindset of building more than we needed to. And so even now we're working to kind of undo that debt and undo that legacy. And our kind of growth plans now are much more focused around how do we resource for the future in a way that is sustainable, that builds in more of these complementary roles that really actually provide an enabler to all of our work, not just kind of adding more developers, which I think is, even with stakeholders internally, like still a bit of a misconception that you can just add a developer and then that's the project, you know, sorted.
Yeah, it'll happen faster. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So we're trying to just break out that people. Mindset. Yeah. So now, you know, inspired a bit by our mentoring, Paul, we're looking at the hub and spoke model, which we sort of, it's obviously it's a model for kind of having a centralized digital team, but then in our case, product managers embedded with each of our focus areas. So we have quite a broad area that we work in as a charity. We work with business, learning, communications, something called systemic initiatives, which are like huge system level change projects. And we are going to place a product manager in each of those teams going forward, and they'll be immersed in those teams. I think that's going to be a massive step forward for us over the next kind of year to 2 years in how we actually embed digital much more across the organisation. And that's kind of our working model at the moment.
It is worth saying at that point that if that sounds interesting to you and you like the idea of working as a product manager, then drop me an email and I will forward it on to Lucy, because there's four roles you're currently looking for, isn't it?
Yes. As and they're not all product managers. No. There will be more product managers, but we've got a number of roles coming
up. So you've got, what were the other ones? You're after a UX designer as well, if I remember, or a UX lead.
Yeah, possibly, yes. And a front-end developer. We're looking for a user-centric data analyst, I think, is someone who...
Yeah, that was the term we made up, wasn't it?
We did,
yeah.
In conversation.
Researcher / analyst, basically.
Someone that can support us on our user research needs, but has a bit of a weighting towards the quantitative methods and support us also with our broader data efforts. And again, there's certain... skills that we are trying to distribute much more widely across the organization, such as being able to run research, use data, do content design. These are things that we need to establish in a sort of decentralized way.
So you
I
went
see what
from...
you mean, Paul. Sorry, I just got to, I see what you mean. It's like, well, yeah, okay, great, done.
I know, right? Yeah, because there's almost, perhaps there is an advantage. This is why I really wanted Lucy on the show, because there almost seems to be an advantage of being a blank slate, right? Starting
no
from
baggage.
Nothing. Yeah, no baggage. You know, you could design things as you want, and, you know, you're not even stuck with out-of-date thinking in terms of how you structure teams. I mean, you're talking about getting user researchers on, you know, about most organizations are still trying to get a project manager, you know, and they're very different environment to be working in. By the way, guys, I meant to say to those of you that are in the chat room, if you've got any questions, you can click in the ask a question button, and we'll add it in, try and add them into the show, because I think it's a really interesting situation that you're in. I mean, of course, the problem is that digital doesn't stand still, and is constantly changing and adapting. So, and you are, there is, and also because of the nature of the charity, everybody is very fast moving, very dynamic, very, yeah, let's do this and let's do that and let's do the other. So there's a constant pressure on you guys to deliver, as there is in most digital teams. How does that leave time for you to stay on top of things? How do you find the time to keep learning these days?
Yeah, it's a good question. I really think it comes back to the fact that it, and maybe this is a bit of an unsatisfactory answer for others, but it is embedded in our organization. I would say we have a learning mindset. We are a learning organization. So in that sense, it's not something that we've had to consciously build in. It's sort of been there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But on a personal note, you know, I do have to create time for it. I always try and have time in my week that's for focused time. And quite often that stuff has to fall into that, those blocks of time. Otherwise, it's so easy to just be on to the next task and the next task. So that's kind of one of the ways. Also, we set up a lot of peer learning opportunities in the organisation. So I'm learning from my teammates all of the time. If there's kind of no barriers to who can kind of set up and run something. So it could be one of our lunchtime learning sessions, but actually it happens even on a much more one-to-one basis or team level basis. So someone might just, we've got our technical lead running JavaScript training for anybody that wants it. I'm running a UX design training for our designers. You know, we've got multiple things happening that sort of bubble up organically, and everybody has the ability to create that as they see fit.
Yeah, and that is a cultural thing, to allow you time and space to do that kind of thing. So Andrew's just asked an interesting question in the chat room, going back to the subject of recruiting staff. How do you go about future-proofing the roles that you're recruiting for? So in other words, how are you, I'm guessing what he's getting at is that it would be very easy just to kind of go off for, you know, on a tangent. You know, you've recruited a load of developers in the past, now you recruit a load of product managers, and actually then down the road you need something else. Do you look far, how far ahead do you look, and what do you do about that kind of thing?
Yeah, great question. I think we always just try and have in mind that our resourcing does match the stuff that we know that we have to deliver, obviously, but we're also always looking a little bit ahead. And it's difficult to look too far ahead in digital, but as an organization, we are hugely ambitious. We have like 2025 visions, and they're massively ambitious for our charitable objectives. And we can't obviously pin our digital work explicitly against that, but we have to meet the organization in their ambition. And so we have to also be flexible in that kind of hub and spoke model. And I feel fairly comfortable with that at the moment, because as I've sort of said, we're filling in the roles that, you know, in an ideal world would have been there sooner. So I feel quite quite comfortable that they're not going to end up, you know, not being needed. And actually the product managers will do slowly and over time, and as they're needed. And we might, you know, we're not going to hire all these people at once. We need to kind of experiment with it and see how it's going. But we have really interesting, we've just been doing a big look at our priorities as an organization for digital. And we have this huge program of activity, which is really strategic for us on the systems level change piece, but digital isn't doing very much for them at the moment. And that's because the conversation isn't there yet with them about how digital can support what they're doing. And starting those conversations internally and connecting that to a potential future product manager who can drive that thinking in their team, I think is where we're going with it.
I think it's also, I mean, with the product owners that we've been talking about putting in place, there has been a longer term plan in that we were talking about how that is a step towards digital becoming ubiquitous across the organization, that, you know, by embedding digital specialists in different parts of the organization, you start to introduce digital skills and expertise at every level. So you are being pretty strategic, I think, in your approach to those kinds of roles.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And actually that is the big picture of this. This is ultimately a digital transformation objective as well.
Marcus, just a second. I wrote a post a while ago that I wanted to mention. I'll put it in the show notes, where I talk about some research from Stanford that I've been going through with Ellen MacArthur Foundation, where it shows how you move down that road to digital transformation. So if you're interested in that, that'll be in the show notes. Marcus, sorry.
All I was going to say was, this is absolutely right, and you do have to try and plan. You do have to be as strategic as possible. But my experience of kind of trying to find the right people to fit into a team, it's just a case of we really need somebody. Get that person in, and then that kind of works out, and then the next thing comes along, and yeah, okay, we really need to get this person in. So I think there's a certain amount of kind of suck it and see. With these things, you don't know, do you?
Yeah.
You're taking a punt that we keep falling short in a particular area, we therefore need somebody else. But then the work might change a year later, and then it's not required. But you're never going to know that. So
no,
you can only plan as much, so much.
Exactly. Kat is flexible.
Kat is making a really good point, or bringing up a very important issue, which I think has been key to your success, which is she's asking how senior is the buy-in within the organization. Now, Kat works at a university, which is obviously an enormous organization with many levels of hierarchy. So, you know, her level of contact with the vice chancellor would be fairly low. You have a much more connected relationship. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so I meet with the CEO every month. I have a standing digital meeting where we can talk about what we're up to, what the priorities are at the moment, and he can help lend support to any issues that we're having. So it's these conversations are happening right at the top of the organisation, but we're quite a flat organisation in how we work anyway, so that's helpful. We've also put in place the digital triage, which is a way of prioritising our work. And we were given a slot at the regular leadership team meeting to run triage every time that they have leadership meeting. And that's a great way to escalate the conversations about how we should be spending our time and what our true priorities look like. I mean, that's the area that creates maybe most conflict or debate internally. And it's, you know, traditionally, if you're the digital team, you often get these priorities come to you at the last minute, or you become very much a bit of an end of pipe team, and it's really starting to shift that dynamic, which is so helpful, and actually you can only really do with that, I think, with that level of leadership buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, that seriously impressed me, that I've never, you know, I introduced this idea of digital triage into the organization, but these guys have really run with it in a way that I don't think I've quite encountered before, in the sense that you very much broadened it out. You know, I've always looked at it as a tool for prioritizing digital projects, but you've almost turned it into this is a tool for prioritizing anything, you know. And the fact that it's been embraced at that senior management level is a really impressive testimony to them, I think, really.
Yeah, and it's really helpful for us too, because you can do so much prioritization from where you are in digital, but ultimately the decisions often begin right at the beginning when we're going out, say, for a funding bid for a particular project. You know, quite often what we're going to deliver is somehow specified into that bid. So unless we're thinking about priorities and triage right then, we're not really doing it as well as we could. We've still got a way to go before we get there, but it's looking very positive.
So the fact that we've talked a little bit maybe about how your lack of long-term digital career actually has been advantageous in some ways, you know, that you've come in with this blank slate. Have you felt it to be a disadvantage ever?
Yeah, of course.
In what ways?
I mean, you don't know what you don't know, do you?
And right.
have been moments of realization and sort of aha moments that you think, oh, I wish I'd known that sooner. And, you know, an example, you know, and this is even really recent, Paul, we had a discussion about we were building an in-house digital asset manager, and you really prompted us to say, do you really need to be building it yourselves? You know, this is a common problem. And that was one of those sort of, for me, oh yeah, maybe we don't, you know, it's historical or legacy decisions that have been made that you're just sort of carrying through with. And it's actually, it was a great reminder to me that you need to go back and revisit those. You know, or you find yourself trying to reinvent the wheel, or it's really easy to do. But actually, in the grand scheme of things, we couldn't have got to where we are now if we hadn't have been a little bit naive, a little bit brave, and had a blank slate to start with. We just didn't have, we had no constraints in our thinking.
Yeah, which is wonderful, which is
right? Yeah. Do you suffer from imposter syndrome at all?
Yes.
Yeah. I still do. 20 years later.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, personally speaking, it's hard, you know, it's nerve wracking for me to come onto a podcast like this and talk about being a digital lead. You know, that's quite new for me. And I sort of sort of think, wow, what's my history? And but it's actually, that's what's so nice to have this opportunity, is to actually talk about what we've done. And, you know, we try and take that into our culture as a digital team when we recruit as well. We don't look for what qualifications people have. We look for what they've done. We look at what they can bring in terms of their kind of spirit.
Yes.
Wow.
And that was another reason for me wanting you on the show, is because I think as digital professionals, we can be a bit snobby, and we can go, a marketing person, a comms person taking over a lead of a digital team, but that's going to end in disaster, isn't it? You know? And
1950s it's so Radio 4 man's come back.
Yeah, it's back. Yeah, exactly. You know, but it doesn't, it's not necessarily like that. It depends on the people and the circumstances and having the right culture within the organization. I mean, what this has really driven home for me is how important organizational culture is to success in this kind of stuff. Because the same people had tried to do the same job in a different organization, it would not have worked. But equally, if the same organization had tried to do the same thing, but with different people, it probably wouldn't have worked. It takes that kind of perfect storm in order to pull together properly.
Yeah.
I tell you the other example of, I hope you don't mind me saying this because it's vaguely embarrassing for you.
Should have checked but, for
you.
You should have got me to sign an NDA.
You're going to air my laundry.
Mistake. Yeah. But, you know, I was having this meeting with them, and I was honestly, the first meeting I had, I was gobsmacked. Wow, these guys are so together. They're so great. They know everything. They know about Agile. They know about this. They know about that. They've got all the right working methodology. They've got this sorted. Crap, what am I going to add to this conversation? You know, how can I help these guys? And then I just made a comment about design systems and pattern libraries, right? And you hadn't encountered that term. It just slipped between the gaps, you know? Yeah. And that happens. I mean, that happens to the best of us, even if you've been around for years. You know, I still regularly, you know, the term service design, you know, just came out of the blue one day for me, and I'd never heard it. And I discovered it's a whole industry that I was totally unaware of. You know, so it does happen. You're right. You don't know what you don't know, do you?
Yeah, totally. And it's something, you know, that's a great example, because that is something that is going to save us a huge amount of time, and I really wish we'd discovered sooner. But you know, you can't worry about it. You've kind of just got to crack on, and actually we're pushing that through now as a priority for our team. And that's all that you can do.
And of course, the great thing is that I've got to be a bit careful, because otherwise it starts sounding arrogant on my part, but you had the mechanisms in place.
Doesn't normally stop you, Paul.
Shut up. you know, you had the mechanisms in place to find out what you don't know by bringing other people involved, you know, involving other people in it. But even if you go back to the very beginning of when you started this off, the fact that you began the whole process not by just jumping in, but seeing what other people were doing and how they were approaching it. And that doesn't apply just on a macro level, like, you know, creating a whole team. Even with something like a design system, you can go out there and go, oh, well, how are they solving design systems? How are these people doing it? How are those doing it? And you can learn accordingly. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think there's a sort of maybe a caveat with that as well. It's about not being too dogmatic. You know, it's easy to find the best examples and try and replicate them in your organization. But as you say, culture, again, is so important in how you actually bring that in. And I think it's always a big learning for me as we go through this journey about how you adapt things to work for your particular situation. And that's the hard bit of it, is actually implementing it in the right way that brings everyone along with you in your journey.
Yeah. A digital triage was a great example of that. You had to quite heavily modify what I introduced to you guys in order for it to suit your organization and your circumstances.
Yeah.
And that's good to see. You know, I think that's the way it should be with stuff like that. Nothing should be set in stone. You know, whether you're talking about how to run a design sprint or how to do digital triage or top task analysis or any other buzzword that you happen to throw into the mix, you've got to customize it for your circumstances.
I mean, I'm always reminded how much digital is actually about people. And it's really easy from the outside looking in to think digital is all about the technology, and it's so much about the people, and that's such a huge priority in actually making it work, that I constantly remind myself, and I constantly make myself double down on my efforts to engage others in it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, you mentioned earlier the government digital service, which have done incredible things, you know, in the way that they've revolutionized government and the way that they've introduced better ways of working and the cost savings that they've made and all the rest of it. You know, they win awards and all the rest of it. But when I was up there chatting with them, their one regret is that they, in the early days, they bulldozed too many people. They bounced people along rather than brought them with them. And that now they're living with some of the legacy of that, where it, from the outside world, everybody thinks they're wonderful and jolly. But within government, they're not particularly liked in some situations. So, yeah, you're totally right. You've got to bring people with you.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I wonder what they sort of come up against now. I wonder how that is playing out for them.
Well, from what I can gather, it's certain parts of the organization wanting to pull back control to them rather than it being centralized, which isn't entirely bad because that kind of has to happen at some point anyway, but it's not being done in a kind of a natural evolution way so much as we want control back, you know, understandable reaction. Totally understand all sides of it. And in some ways, I would argue perhaps to a degree, in an organization like the government, there was probably no way around it, right? While in an organization like yours, where it's much more open to change, that culturally it's much flatter, then it's probably not as necessary to be that kind of tough guy, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if your background, Lucy, in comms actually helped you kind of communicate what you were trying to do internally rather than being the big tough guy. You were actually selling it internally. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure that's all sort of fed in. And I was working a bit in marketing psychology. I haven't been, actively sort of using those kind of techniques, but I think I've always had an awareness of the importance of how people respond to it. So I think it's there. It's also embedded also in digital in any way, isn't it? Sort of the whole user process.
But you say that, we don't often do it. You know, the number of times I come across, you know, user experience professionals that just moan about other stakeholders and other people in their organization without taking any time to understand their pain points, what they're trying to achieve, all of those kinds of things. And that really bugs me. You know, if you're going to call yourself a user experience person, you need to apply the same principles you're learning in user experience to your own stakeholders.
Yes, totally. It's really, you've got the toolkit. It's all there. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, let's wrap up. But I want to wrap up with one last piece of advice, or one last question, which is, what advice would you give to somebody who was in your situation 4 years ago, where they've suddenly been given, you know, this responsibility for digital, but they're not really, wouldn't call themselves a digital professional? What would you say to them?
I think it's to have a learning mindset. I mean, things move on so quickly that actually having a learning mindset is probably the key to being able to keep up with the rate of change and learn what you need to learn along the way. Not be intimidated by the lack of experience, but be open to what you can learn. And also find a network that can support you. You don't have to be well connected. You really don't. It could be anyone. Mentors can be anybody, really. I think you need to be really open-minded about what a mentor looks like and go out and speak to these people, because they are there. They might even just be a friend of a friend, but it's been the most helpful source of support in our journey so far.
You know, that's incorrect. You need an expensive consultant mentor who looks like a snooker player.
No, he also has their place. Yeah.
You are, of course, entirely right. You know,
we couldn't have afforded you at the beginning, Paul.
Oh dear, I'm really not that expensive. So you are entirely right. That's why I love meetups. That's why I love going to conferences, making the time for all of those kinds of things. It's absolutely so crucial. And you know, with a lot of these things are free. they cost nothing but time. I mean, take, for example, Lucy, we met up, didn't we, recently at a UserZoom conference that was being put on for free by the UserZoom people because they wanted to win a load more clients. But it wasn't a salesy conference, and there was actually really good content there where you learned lots about how different organisations were approaching things. And then you have, you know, you talk with people in the breaks and all of that. So, yeah, totally agree. Okay. Right. Second sponsor time. So
this is the good bit.
This is Marcus is particularly excited. After zoning out on the last sponsor slot, suddenly he gets interested. The reason is we had a couple of sponsor slots left over at the end of the season. So I thought we would use them to talk about some of the stuff that I do, but also some of the stuff Headscape does. And it's Headscape's turn this week. So, and Marcus is rubbish at promoting Headscape, so I'm going to do it. Because every time he does it, he goes waffly. And he, I mean, how he makes a living as a salesman is quite beyond me, right?
I'm endearing,
and anyway,
Paul. That's
and I've written as well, Marcus is rubbish at promoting Headscape, so I'm going to do it. He doesn't know I'm going to do it because he never reads the show notes. And that's written in the show notes. And I bet he didn't know we were going to do it. Did you, Marcus?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
You told me.
Oh, I told you, yeah.
There you go. Paul hasn't got any more memory. I don't read the notes. Paul can't remember what he told me. There you go.
So what are we going to do? We've reached that age, Marcus. Mm. Let's talk about Headscape. So what do they do, first of all? They do research and discovery stuff. They do a lot of strategy type work as well. And then obviously they do design and development. So they really do kind of that end-to-end experience when it comes to designing a website. But then what their strategy stuff isn't necessarily just the website in isolation. They might be looking at other areas as well, like social media, or they might be, you do quite a lot of analytics analysis because Chris is really good at that.
These days as well, Paul.
Yep. Content kind of stuff, do a lot of stakeholder interviews and usability testing, all of that kind of stuff that you'd expect. Right. Who do they do it for? They work in a whole load of different sectors, but their biggest sectors are the charity sector. Lucy, just make note of that. Heritage
sector.
She's
got her own team. She doesn't need us.
Yeah, she doesn't need the likes of you. The heritage sector, higher education, and law. What a weird mix, Marcus.
It is a weird mix. But we've just literally just finished. We're probably going to have a kind of catch-up, you know, review call with the client tomorrow for the end of our first higher education / law client. Basically, a law school.
Oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So there you go.
Well, you've done a charity / law / heritage, if you think about it, because the Environmental Defence Fund would have kind of fallen into all three of those.
Maybe. I suppose, yeah. But yeah, charity and higher education. Higher education, we started in 2003, and we've worked with over 50 higher education organisations now.
Is it that many?
So, yeah, that's our biggest sector. And charity, I guess, has kind of come off the back of that, because I think people who work in HE will often go and work in charities, and people we get work from people kind of just saying, I've gone here now, can you come and help me out? That kind of thing. And the law thing was just weird. I won't tell the story now. Save it for another day.
Because everybody, all the other sectors, charity, heritage, and higher education, they're all nice people, aren't they? Law, not so much.
The law school.
I could say that because I've got no law clients.
Lawyers are interesting people. That's certainly worth saying. I mean, they're super bright. They are kind of super driven. So sometimes you can get some lovely ones, and sometimes you can get some people. I'm feeling a little bit nervous in this interview. You know, sort of moving around like that. But no, great fun, and they've also got lots of money. So you can therefore do a proper project. You're not cutting corners.
Stop talking, Marcus.
Stop talking.
You dug
Marcus.
A hole.
Carry on.
So I have to say, I am a non-executive director of the company, so I may be slightly biased. But these are the four reasons why I would hire Headscape. Right. One.
I've got one extra at the end as well. Carry on.
One, and I don't want to say this first one because it pains me deeply, they are actually a pleasure to work with. They're a really nice bunch of people, and I like them a lot. Second, they've got some exceptionally good designers and coders. The quality of work that they produce is outstanding. But the other thing I like about them is they're both pragmatic and business orientated. So, you know, they're not going to make you do, you know, 20 hours of usability testing just because, you know,
that's part
you're
of
supposed
the process.
To do that. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It goes back to what we were saying earlier, isn't it?
Yeah,
and they're flexible. Very details orientated, because Chris Scott, who's the other founder of the company alongside me and Marcus, is seriously OCD. He has deep psychological issues that actually works out very well if you're a client. So that's why I would hire them. Go on, Marcus, what do you want to add to it?
I think it was Dan, one of our tech lead I was talking to the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was Dan that said, do you know what our strap line should be? And this is after we've been talking about many, many current client projects, should we say, and how they're being dealt with by their other suppliers. And basically, yeah, our strap line should be, we don't lie to you.
Yeah.
So that's a reason to hire us.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one. Dan made a good point. Mm. Andrew in the chat room, who Headscape have worked with Andrew. Have you worked with Andrew?
We've worked with Andrew, but obviously I know him well from IWMW. Yeah.
No. So he says we're good at supporting the community as well, which basically is...
We buy the drinks.
You buy the drinks. Yeah, buy the drinks at conferences. That's what he's getting at there. Okay, so Marcus, wrap us up. What joke have we got? I'm sorry, Lucy, as I explained to you before the show starts, we've got the stupid tradition where Marcus has to tell a dad joke.
I'm looking forward to it.
oh, lower your expectations quite dramatically.
No, that's me done for. Is Lyle in the room today? I don't think he is.
So no, he's
but
not.
Lyle put a joke onto the Barag Wills Slack channel earlier, which I quite liked. Sad to hear the news today that the inventor of the speedboat has died. The funeral will be held tomorrow, followed shortly by the wake.
Oh, no.
Boom. Come on. Oh, that's not
good
bad.
Drop the mic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is it for this show. Lucy, thank you so much for coming on. It was very much appreciated.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope it wasn't too painful.
It was all right.
Okay. Yeah,
it was all right.
You were going to say pleasure then, but actually,
yeah,
no, that's
all right.
That's
as good as we could get. Next week, who knows? Because it's all messed up now. We had last week's show come through, so we've moved things around. It's all just confused. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen anymore. I've lost control of my podcast. But we'll see. So until then, thank you for watching or listening, if you are listening. And goodbye. Bye.